The reality which we experience can best be described as a portion of the universe which is elsewhere moving forward, picking up elements, energy as it goes. Basic components of our section must move to occupy certain loci because they and we are involved in a temporary reverse flow. We invent explanations, motives for such movements to occupy such loci at such times, thus filling our reverse-moving section with forward-moving verbal gabble, i.e., ideas. Our frequent strong sense of destiny or inevitability is explained by this. We must do certain things, be certain places at a certain time. Some enormous force impels us, Ananki. Evidently, an enormously powerful explosion hurled us backward in time, that explosion being represented in our view as lying ahead of us toward which we are moving. We will eventually all occupy the places we were in just before the explosion occurred. Actually, the explosion already took place in the past of the total universe, its past, our future. For us, it lies at the end of things toward which they move. But since there are two times, opposed fields, as the explosion hurls us farther and farther away, its force, that particular time direction, weakens, and the opposite moving one, which drives us toward the explosion, takes over progressively more. It is as if I hit a ball uphill. It rolls and rolls upward. Then a point comes where the force I imparted balances gravity, and stasis occurred. Then gravity causes it to begin to roll downward again, until finally it's back where it began, and I hit it once more. These are the expansion contractions of the universe. In a sense, the universe can be read both ways. But I think the way, direction, we read it is backward. Actually, in 1972, I did not go to Fullerton. I returned to Fullerton. My trip must be read backward. In the true past, comprehended by me wrongly as the future, I had been there already. My vision of Mexico, of Fullerton then, in late 1971, was actually, are you ready, a memory of Fullerton. I knew what it was like because I remembered it, memory moving in the correct direction. Possibly, even very likely, this is a limited throwback of a subsection of the universe. Our section will cease to move retrograde one day, eventually, get back to where it was, and then move in the proper direction. Move forward along a different time path. I will be living in Fullerton, etc. Then I could leave it, etc. Arbitrarily, say in the year 1980, we are back to the moment of direction reverse. The Go board, which I saw, although it looked like space, was in actuality time. The teleological force, TF, placed events at certain intersections, in time, placed them there before the forward motion of time reached them. The TF arranged them, distributed them in a pattern in time, as we distributed the buttons on a Go board in space, set them economically here and there. I guess space too was represented. The nexus was a space-time nexus. It reached back into time and placed buttons ahead of time. The opposing force could only surge forward like a tide. March 74, a time rollback. The force or pressure emanating from the future, moving backward, retrograde. Forward vertical time reinstated itself almost at once, but the short or brief interval revealed otherwise unsuspected weaker forces, concealed by the massive universal field of forward time. It was almost a time vacuum into which many elements rushed. Or, the activity of other fields, always there but concealed, were temporarily visible as they did their constant work. Equilibrium was briefly lost, in conformity to Lem's analysis. Had there by any chance been a Soviet experiment with Kozyrev time? By his theories, it would be experienced everywhere at once. By those sensitive to time fluctuations, such as precogs? Would they then want feedback info from distant tracking stations? Of course the Soviets would anticipate only category disruption, not an influx of a retrograde field. This would be incorrectly conceived of by those affected as an ESP experiment. with the addition, not from Soviet sources, of the presence of the retrograde force, the Holy Spirit or Logos. Implication that retrograde time is forward time, which is past the turning point, passed through infinity, so to speak, has formerly been forward time and possesses the accumulation which Bergson speaks of, time as acquiring. Then, as it turns the eye, so to speak, and starts back, it is freighted with the accumulated load of knowledge information, which may comprise the wisdom associated with the Logos. All that wisdom was acquired in its forward tracking. It is information rich. Logically, then, in its retrograde tracking, it would divest itself of its knowledge, teach rather than learn, so that when it arrived at the other end, it would be information poor, even info empty, make the swing, and begin to acquire once more. I think the ongoing time field momentarily weakened in March. Is it possible that was due to a Soviet experiment a la Kozyrev? The time disruption for me was so great, so spectacular, that I can't believe it was due to me, intended for me, aimed at me, etc. It was an historic event in which I merely played an accidental receiving role. My precogability is an index of my sensitivity to the retrograde field, maybe. My subcortical impressions in March would indicate, not that time leaped back, but that it jumped forward about 2,000 years. It had just been circa 180 AD. What is most distressing is the notion here of phony memories generated, as under hypnosis, to fill in. They'd be the ones of Fullerton, the conscious continuity. The others, of Rome, would be the real ones, depicting the actuality. The conjunctive ones, of the interval, would be merely to paste over so as to reveal no rent. It is as if time went directly from 10 AD to 1974 AD, with nothing in between, but it was pasted in retrospectively, to give verisimilitude. The significance in all this of my "Is the world real?" would be that we continually patch over the ellipses with fake memories in order to give uninterrupted continuity. Hence, in me arise certain epistemological doubts related to and deriving from the above-experienced phenomena. At this point, one could begin to take it, my writing, very seriously, since everything seems to coalesce into something of meaning. The sense of unreality fits in, the disruption of the ontological categories, the sacerdotal power buried for eons. It is all of a piece, plus the world of Ubik per se. But the meaning is unsuspected, anyhow, by me, i.e., I seem to have taken a number of unrelated, unusual experiences or themes to write about. But on closer examination, they all group around the time disruption matter. The others are collateral, such as the false memories, etc., which, for God's sake, I seem to personally have experienced in my amnesias, several of them. These are indeed based on personal experiences in my life over 10 years. What if prior amnesias were pasteovers over prior disjunctions totally unsuspected? The vivid dreams, like of Mexico and two more, China and India, space-time periods where I went and returned, no drugging at all involved, then pasted over. We're talking about jumps forward, jumps back. I was somewhere during the preview of Fullerton, but I wasn't taken. I disjuncted forward in time, to this time. The novel or movie technique which comes to mind is splice. The splicing in of a scene, the joining of two scenes with something which had been between eliminated. But this is all less of a breakdown and more like a repair. If, however, that experience were regarded as a demonstration of God's power rather than a natural event, a miracle in fact, what was revealed? Rome, circa 180 AD, would not be what in some way time jumped back to, or I jumped back to, or anyone came here from, but a demonstration that this world of Fullerton 1974 exists only because he causes it to exist, and if he wishes, he can roll it aside to reveal whatever he wants. He can cause any other world he wishes to replace it on the spot. The meaning is God, although the revelation is of Rome. Here one can turn Fullerton to Rome by 1. Adding, i.e. a layer of enchantment, so that Fullerton became Rome by acquiring something which was lacking. Or 2. Simply altered, I was in Fullerton, then I was in Rome, it was different. Or 3. Something similar to an enchantment was removed, and Fullerton became Rome. Of the 3, it was the last which happened. I was still in Fullerton, but layers were stripped, veils of illusion, what remained was much simpler, was Rome, with both good and bad parts. Rome lay underneath. It was always really there, if we could penetrate to that foundation. It is an important realization. The transformation came by the removal of something, what was, I guess, not real or not as real. Was this form regression a la Ubik? One would no more expect to find the Morphos Rome buried within Fullerton than to find the LaSalle car buried within the rocket ship. Letter to Claudia Bush, February 16, 1975. 4-190. Dear Claudia, why would God take His sole Son, whom He loved, and send Him here? Especially in view of the outcome, His only begotten Son was eventually discovered by the authorities and slaughtered in a cruel and humiliating way. After a short interval, of course, as might be expected, His Son returned to life, demonstrating to His small group of friends who He was, and then He left here and returned to His Father. No one has seen Him since. The first thing you think of is, boy, that sure showed bad planning on the part of God. Or, boy, God sure allowed His only begotten Son to suffer a lot. Just how much did God, in fact, really love His Son to let that happen? The Christian account doesn't tell us enough to figure it out, so it's convincing. There is an enigma here, for those who believe and for those who don't. In the immortal words of Mr. Spock, it does not compute. The story of Zagreus, however, sheds light on this, very fascinating light, and it starts then to compute. Zeus sent Zagreus, his favorite son, whom he had allowed to sit beside him on his heavenly throne, to earth in order to hide him from Hera, according to the myth. But that doesn't seem to me very important. What is important is the motive. Zagreus' father wanted his son to blend, to mingle, to pass, to disappear, to be in appearance just one more child born among millions. Notice how this fits the story about King Herod searching high and low, having the babies executed, etc. See? Now, does it begin to make sense? Especially when you recall that one of the medieval views, discarded, was that this world was either built by an evil god, or anyhow, the plan went wrong, and this world degenerated, and so a stranger god, that is, a god from somewhere else in the universe, from outside, came here to fix things up for us and make our world come out right. However, he was found out and killed. This stranger god was the Christ, disguised as a carpenter. It didn't work. The disguise was eventually penetrated and he was arrested, mainly through the paid informer within Christ's circle. There is much quasi-political intrigue here, is there not? It becomes obvious why Jesus spoke of the prince of this world, who was his antagonist and who would eventually kill him as he did. Take both these stories, that of Zeus's motive plus the medieval account, and you get this. A child is born who is in danger and must be protected by being disguised. Zagreus, while still a baby, was lured with toys by the Titans, killed and eaten. Zeus slew the Titans with thunderbolts, laser beams. The Titans were our ancestors. Put another way, we are their descendants. We are Titans. That is the name of our race compared to his. He is of another race and from another place. Everything he was, everything he represented, was a mere opposite of what the Titan race is and values. Thus, death would absolutely for sure follow if his disguise was penetrated, if the Titans, ourselves, our rulers, figured it out, figured out that 1, he was here as Herod did, and 2, which of all the newborn babies was the outsider, this stranger posing as a Titan child. If he lived long enough before being discovered, he could and would begin subtly to alter the plan of this world. He didn't live long, either as Zagreus or as Jesus. Unless one assumes that everything that happened to Jesus was exactly according to God's plan, then it is reasonable to say that he was found out fairly soon and did not accomplish nearly as much as was hoped for, in which case there had been some success but a lot of failure. The answer was obviously to make the attempt again at a later date, i.e., he would return, but the next time, not as a lamb to be slaughtered, but as a king and judge, which is to say, in strictly Greek terms, as Zeus, rather than the baby Zagreus. As a matter of fact, Zagreus came back too, as Dionysus, proving that you cannot kill this particular ETL, extraterrestrial life form. Well, you can kill it, but it is immortal. Like the corn, the vine, the grain of wheat, it returns larger and stronger, more evolved, more complete, more mature, whatever, than before. Death is only its foe as long as it has taken the disguise or mode of human form. Having done so, it falls victim automatically to what all humans are prey to. But when that body, that human body, dies, it itself is released. It has no physical mortal body. It only assumed one for one of the above purposes, either to assist us or to mingle for its own sake, to be disguised. The worst thing, for themselves anyhow, for the Titans, our cannibal ancestors, to do was to devour this life form after they had murdered it. Thereupon it entered them and was passed down to their heirs somehow in the DNA coding, in a dormant creeped morphosis or sleeping form. It sleeps within each of us, waiting to be reawakened, which is exactly what Plato meant by anamnesis, recollection. That which induces anamnesis in any one of us is the external disinhibiting symbol on which we were engrammed originally, at the time he, Jesus, was here. It is the more elaborate ideogram beneath the fish symbol, but alas, the fish symbol has been obliterated by the symbol of the cross. The anticipated disinhibition is postponed. Each of us has this second stage programming series of systems waiting to be disinhibited by the proper sign, which unconsciously we will recognize, i.e., remember, when and if we ever encounter it. These constitute the entire series of metamotivational systems which Maslow has begun to identify. Note: Abraham Maslow, 1908 to 1970, was an American psychologist famous for his concept of peak experience and the notion that humans are driven by a hierarchy of needs. End note. They are real. They are asleep within us, slumbering and waiting. I will now quote directly from the New Britannica, Volume 12, page 783. The Macro. The theological doctrine of the soul and the myth about its celestial home, its fall, and its redemption were inseparable. The sequence is beautifully told in The Hymn of the Soul, preserved in the Acts of Thomas, an apocryphal account of the journeys and death of the apostle, in which some episodes were certainly transmitted from pagan mystery texts. The hero of the hymn, who represents the soul of man, is born in the eastern, the yonder kingdom. Immediately after his birth, he is sent by his parents on a pilgrimage into the world with instructions to take a pearl from the mouth of a dragon in the sea. Instead of wearing his heavenly garment, he dresses in earthly clothes, eats earthly food, and forgets his task. Then his parents send a letter to rouse him. As soon as he has read the letter, he awakes and remembers his task, takes the pearl, and begins the homeward journey. On the way, his brother, the Redeemer, comes to accompany him and leads him back home to his father's palace in the east. This myth is a figurative representation of the theological doctrine of the soul's fall and its return to heaven. I came across this account yesterday or the day before. As soon as I read it, I knew I had found the key which put together just about everything I've been thinking, learning, and experiencing, as I'm sure you'll agree. Do you? There is little more that I can say, especially considering the beauty of this text. Note: The Hymn of the Soul, also known as the Hymn of the Pearl, is a numinous fable of spiritual homecoming that captures, more than any narrative of antiquity, Dick's noetic vision of anamnesis. The Acts of Thomas was a 3rd century apocryphal Christian text, most likely of Syriac origin. But the hymn, sung by Thomas in prison, is clearly an interpolation, though it shows the influence of the New Testament. Some scholars think it is a Mesopotamian fairy tale, or possibly the remnant of a pre-Christian Gnostic tradition whose very existence remains controversial. Of particular importance for an understanding of Dick is the role of the letter. When the occluded hero breaks the seal, the words written on my heart were in the letter for me to read. Making his way home, the hero finds the letter again lying in the road, like a beer can or a piece of trash. Later in the exegesis, Dick discusses the Xerox missive in terms influenced by the hymn, though the values are inverted. Once home, the hero puts on holy robes that, in Barnstone's translation, quiver all over with the movements of gnosis, and that mirror him like a divine twin, two entities but one form. E.D. End note. How does it strike you? What I find personally fascinating is that I have been absolutely positive since last April or so that my entire experience was somehow triggered off the experience I now would deem that of anamnesis in Plato's sense, by the dark-haired stranger girl who came to my door in late February 1974 wearing the goldfish sign in necklace form, the sign of which fascinated me so that I could not take my eyes off it or off her. I had been expecting her most of my life, those black eyes, that black hair, and around her neck, that gleaming gold chain of links culminating in the fish. I still remember saying to her, as if in a daze, "What is that you are wearing?" And the girl touching it and saying, "It's a sign that the early Christians used. My husband gave it to me." And then she was gone. And as I'm sure I told you, when a month or so later I went by the pharmacy which had sent her out with the medication for me, they had no idea who she was, what her name was, or where she had gone. But she was gone, forever. They just smiled. Can you see how close this is to the hymn of the soul? Perhaps this was purely an accidental disinhibiting, perhaps not. But it did cause anamnesis in me. And as I'm sure you realize, I did not know, had never heard of, such matters within the human heart or mind or history. I think one day, perhaps soon, someone certainly, and not by accident, will display to us our collective disinhibiting sign, and anamnesis will occur for us all, for us anyhow, who it's intended for. What do you say, dear?